Hey, good morning, everybody. This is March 26th, a Thursday. It's the first day after your second test. And we were in the middle of the sensory chapter when we stopped last week, so we're going to pick up sensory chapter. And let's see, what do I know? All the tests are graded, they're in line, some people are stopping by to look at their exams. That's a really good thing to do. And I'm turning some of these lights down. How about that? That sounds good. All right, so I'll try to get this recording up on the internet for you really fast so you can listen to it over spring break. And anybody that's not here, if you have some friends that aren't here, you can tell them I'm going to drop them from the class. But don't have them email me, okay? Just freak them out. I maybe won't drop them from the class, but you can tell them I said that. All right. So let's pay attention a little bit. So if you got to carry on a conversation, that's cool with me. But go ahead, step outside. All right, so that you don't disturb people around you. Okay. So let's look at the schedule. So what did we say? 26th today. Yeah, indeed. We're going to finish up sensory physiology, maybe. But then next week is spring break. Please don't come to campus. I don't think the library is open. Maybe some of the buildings are open, some of the people are working, but I don't think there'll be many instructors here. All right, so when we come back, all right, we're going to, on April 7th, we're going to finish up sensory, get into endocrinology, so take a look at that chapter. And during spring break, on Thursday, there is not a weekly assignment due. All right, so that's just a vacation. Your next weekly assignment will be due on April 9th. But if you want to get it done on April 2nd, that's fine with me, right? Because it's going to be available there, and then you're going to be 1 week ahead, and then you never have to worry about missing a online quiz. And some people have been missing online quizzes. That's not good for your grade. It's okay to get a low grade every once in a while, but not a zero. It's hard to average zeros out, right? So pay really close attention to that. And because you all know this is a hybrid class and you have online work to do. All right, so when is your next exam? It's going to be on a Thursday. And so, what do you know about that? So it's one, two, wow, I got mixed up already. So today's the 26th, so 3 weeks away. Looks like 3 weeks. All right, did somebody ask me a question about that? Yeah, so 3 weeks away, and it's going to be 10, 11, 12, and 13. All right, so we can't mess around too much, because we've got to cover some material. All right, any question on the syllabus? No? On schedule, all that looks good. All right, any questions on sensory chapter so far? You're good with sensory chapter? Nice. All right, so we are looking at, what happened to my cursor? Oh, there we go, okay. Special senses. No, we're looking at generator potentials. Okay, so what, so here I see a couple. Here's a plot of something, and the axes aren't even on the graph to let you know what you're looking at. So the vertical is voltage, right? And the horizontal is just time. And I see a dotted line that says threshold, all right? So I see a nice dark line right here. And what does that look like to you? Yeah, an action potential, right? So that threshold is just the threshold voltage. When those voltage, sodium voltage gated channels open up and potassium voltage gated channels, right, so you get this typical action potential with this overshoot, right, this area of hyperpolarization. Yeah, it's a relative refractory period. Okay, well, a generator potential are equivalents of EPSPs, which means that they are depolarizing. And so when a receptor cell accepts or receives a stimulus, then it will produce a generator potential, which is proportional to the strength of the stimulus. And if it reaches threshold, then an action potential will take place. If it's a whole bunch of graded potentials that sum together that last a long period of time, right, then that will trigger another action potential after that. So the frequency of action potentials is going to change as the amplitude of these receptor potentials increase. And these generator potentials are produced in response to an adequate stimulus. All right, so what is that adequate stimulus that we talked about? Is it a type of stimulus or an amount of stimulus? Okay, so here, here I see a bunch of generator potentials, right? So this is different amounts of whatever that stimulus is, but an adequate stimulus is a type of stimulus that will produce these kinds of graded potential. So remember that adequate stimulus is a type. So what's the adequate stimulus for your eyes?
Light.
Right? And dim light, bright light, those are both adequate stimulus. So it's not the amount of light, but it's the type of energy. Okay. Okay. Well, we looked at all that already, talked about that. This just shows you, right, that as the stimulus intensity increases in amplitude, then the frequency of action potentials increases going to whatever part of the brain that particular receptor is hooked up to. Like, for instance, if this is a photoreceptor, where do these action potentials go eventually? Occipital lobe. Yeah, that's one of the things that we learn from anatomy. And if these were coming from your ear, where would these action potentials go? Yeah, temporal lobe, right? That's where the primary auditory cortex is. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some special senses. We talked a little bit about general senses. Special senses are a little bit different because, let's name some of them. There is olfaction, okay, which is smell. Somebody said taste. That's the gustatory sense, so that's two. Olfaction, gustation, vision, hearing. All right, what else? Two more. There's an equilibrium. There's two senses of equilibrium that are special sense. Yeah, there's a spinning equilibrium, and then there's a linear equilibrium. All right, so we'll look at both of those, and I think that's everything. So why are those special senses? Well, because you have receptors for those stimuli only in one or two places on your body, and that's it. That's why they're special. As opposed to general senses, you have receptors all over your body, right? Temperature receptors you have all over your body. If I take an ice cube, put it on the back of your knee, you'll feel it. Your belly button, you feel it. Forehead, you feel it, right? But if I take a flashlight and shine it on the back of your knee or on your belly button, you won't appreciate it because you have no receptors there. That light actually has to go into your eye, and you only have two eyes. That's why it is a special sense, and the same with all of these others. Taste, you can only taste with your tongue. Smell, only with your nose. Right, so it's just very specific locations. Let's talk about the gustatory sensation first, or taste. And it's pretty well accepted that there are five primary taste sensations. There's sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami, which is a sense of fulfillment or satisfaction when you eat a food. Okay, and you have different taste buds for each of these primary senses, and you can identify a food by the components of these various senses. So if you have something that's 10% sweet and 30% sour and the rest salty, right, with previous experience you would be able to figure out what kind of food that was. Right? So can you ever remember eating anything where maybe you tasted sweet and sour and salty all at the same time? I'm actually kind of feeling sorry for you because I think of a margarita, right? Do you taste all that stuff on a margarita? Probably, huh?
It's alcohol.
Oh, there's alcohol. Okay, well, that's that umami sense, the sense of fulfillment. Okay, I'm just kidding with that one. All right, so these taste receptor cells are just modified epithelial cells. Here are the epithelial cells of the tongue, and within that epithelium, we can see something that we call a taste bud. A taste bud has receptor cells with these something like cilia projecting right to the oral cavity. They're not quite poking up into the oral cavity, so they're still within this taste bud. And then you have some support cells around the receptor cells. And this is what we call a taste bud. So can you see a taste bud with your naked eye? And you cannot, right? Because I see cells right here. And I think some people are misled a little bit because if you stick your tongue out and take a look at the surface of your tongue, it seems as if you are looking at taste buds, right? But those are not taste buds. Those are what we call papillae, and papillae have thousands of taste buds embedded in them, right? So These taste buds are arranged and aligned on what each of those different papillae. And in order for you to appreciate a taste and molecule, it has to dissolve in saliva, and then that saliva has to bring it into through the taste pore into the taste bud, and then a molecule, right, has to bind to receptors on a taste hair cell, right? Or maybe if it's salty, maybe it just enters the cell, right? If it's sodium chloride that you're eating, maybe that sodium just enters. And when sodium enters, because you're eating a salty pretzel, what happens to that cell that has a sodium channel? It depolarizes, which is excitatory, right? So some of these are pretty simple to appreciate. So let's look at four basic kinds of taste sensations. So here's a taste receptor cell that we find in a taste bud. Here are some of those stereocilia or hair projections that come up. And here I see a sodium channel, and this sodium channel is open all the time. So that when you eat something salty, right, sodium chloride dissociates into sodium ion. That sodium ion can enter through that sodium channel. And as you told me already, that depolarizes the cell, and you know that to be excitatory. That depolarization causes the opening of voltage-gated calcium channels. And I think you remember that calcium is a good signal, in most cases, to move vesicles, yeah, over to the cell membrane for exocytosis of neurotransmitter. All right, so these calcium channels open only when the cell is depolarized. The cell is depolarized only in the presence of sodium. So that makes really good sense. All right, and so this is an excitatory neurotransmitter on this nerve. Sour, on the other hand, is the result of hydrogen ions or an acid environment. And those hydrogen ions can pass right through proton channels in these hair cells. And when a proton enters, of course, that causes depolarization because the proton is positive. And that will work the same way by opening these calcium channels, and that helps move these neurotransmitters in these vesicles over to the cell membrane for exocytosis. And this is an excitatory neurotransmitter, so it depolarizes the sensory neuron. Okay, so it depends on the receptors on the membrane of these different taste cells. Let's look at two more cases. All right, so the first two are just simple ion channels, but the next two are G-protein coupled receptors. We've looked at some already, but here's another important kind of G-protein coupled receptor. So a sugar, and can you see that this little molecule right here kind of looks like a sugar because it looks like a stop sign or something, right? It's got these six sides to it. Well, that particular shape then can bind to the receptor of the G-protein that will activate the G-protein, and maybe one of the subunits will bump into an enzyme and create another second messenger which runs around inside the cell. In this particular case, if it's a sugar or an amino acid, right, the second messenger goes to a potassium channel, right, and if it closes a potassium channel, what happens to this cell? Now, these potassium channels are open all the time, okay, and so potassium is leaking out. So what happens when the cell is leaking potassium in terms of the voltage?
Less positive.
It's less positive, becomes more negative, right, in when these potassium channels are open, becomes less positive. And if it's at resting membrane potential or below, what is below resting membrane potential? Hyperpolarization, right? So this cell is hyperpolarized at rest. When the sugar binds to the receptor, these potassium channels close, and that stops that hyperpolarization and even produces depolarization. That depolarization, okay, moves these vesicles over to the cell membrane for exocytosis. I was looking for calcium. I don't see calcium here. It probably opens calcium channels in the cell membrane. All right, I'll have to look that up. Let's look at the fourth case. Bitter. A good molecule that will stimulate bitter receptors is quinine. Probably you can get some quinine in drinks like in tonic water, might give you a good representation of what bitter tastes like. So if a bitter tasted molecule binds to that G-protein coupled receptor, that causes the buildup of a second messenger, and that second messenger, right, will act on the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And what are the functions? Tell me all the functions of smooth endoplasmic reticulum. What is it? What do you know for that? It builds something. What does it build? Rough ER makes proteins. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum makes lipids, right? Rough makes proteins. Smooth makes lipids or modifies lipids. All right, but another important function of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is that it stores calcium. So it's sort of like a bone, right? But it's in an ionic form in solution. So that second messenger then, all right, will bind to the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, opening up calcium channels. What's the concentration of calcium normally inside the cell, in the cytoplasm, cytosol? It's almost close to zero, right? It's high outside. And since it's high inside the smooth ER, then it just diffuses out very rapidly. And then that calcium signal causes exocytosis of excitatory neurotransmitter on the sensory neuron. All right, so these are exam figures. So you should appreciate that some tastant modalities are due to ion channels, and the rest are due to G-protein coupled receptors. Some work by manipulating potassium channels. Other second messengers work by causing release of calcium from smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so that's all five of them all together.
So,
yes.
So for these, you know, they release the calcium as a neutron transmitter?
Calcium will be released into this cell, and that calcium causes the release of neurotransmitter in these vesicles. Calcium itself is not a neurotransmitter. Okay, is that what you asked? Is calcium a neurotransmitter? Is that what you asked? Yeah, calcium is not a neurotransmitter. If it was a neurotransmitter, then calcium inside the cell would have to diffuse across the synaptic cleft and bind to a receptor in the postsynaptic cell. And it doesn't do that. It works within the presynaptic cell. And it causes the presynaptic cell to release neurotransmitter. Okay? And then the neurotransmitter, whatever it is, moves across the synapse to receptors in the sensory neuron, causing depolarization. Okay, so I don't know of any example of where calcium is used as a neurotransmitter. It's usually an important controlling molecule inside the cell. Yeah.
So the neurotransmitter is being released, that's what allows us to like decipher what taste
we're tasting. Okay, well, what allows us to decipher what kind of taste we're tasting? Okay, well, these cells right here respond, like this one right here, bitter, only to the shape of bitter kinds of molecules, not to sweet, right, not to sour, not to salty. And so it's going to release neurotransmitter on this neuron right here. And how you appreciate bitter is because it's going to the gustatory cortex, but a specific part that's responsible for bitter. Okay, so if we wanted to rewire somebody's brain and take the sensory neuron, which is going to get action potentials when a bitter tasted molecule is there, we'll take this axon and take it to a different part that's responsible for sweet, then you'll have the sensation of sweetness. Right? So it all depends on where these action potentials go in the cerebral cortex in terms of what does it taste like. All right, and then the frequency will determine how strong a taste it is. Okay. Next sense, olfaction, sense of smell. So here, what do we have right here? Well, it looks like a nice frontal bone, right? Little maxilla, here's sphenoid, and then we got the ethmoid bone in between. And I see some nerves actually projecting down into the nasal cavity, right around that superior nasal conchae. And this is really the only place in your body that I know of where you have part of your nervous system dangling outside of your body just in free space. All right, so you remember this is the cribriform plate. All these little holes are the olfactory foramina, right? And here now I can see some of these olfactory nerves going through. So there's an epithelium that lines your nasal cavity, and you have a number of different kinds of cells. You have bipolar cells. What did you learn the function of a bipolar neuron? Yes, special sense of some kind. Here's a good example for smell. And again, odorant molecules have to bind to cilia on this receptor cell, which will then depolarize it, and then it's going to release excitatory neurotransmitter on the sensory neurons of the olfactory bulb, and then that's going to take it to the olfaction center of the brain. So these other epithelial cells sometimes support the job of these bipolar receptor cells. Sometimes they will detoxify compounds that are in your nasal cavity, which is damaging, and that happens all the time. And you also have bipolar cells. Here I see a bipolar cell, and it doesn't have an axon going a long distance. It doesn't go through the ethmoid bone up into the olfactory bulb. It is just sitting right here. And this is interesting because this is a neuron, and it is a stem cell. Because this environment is very rough, right? Anything that's in the air will have access to these cells. And so these neurons live only for a short period of time. And after they die, we wouldn't have any sense of smell at all, except these stem cells can differentiate and regenerate these bipolar cells. So here's an interesting part of the nervous system that does regenerate itself fairly rapidly. Right. But now if the stem cells, if you breathe something in that's very, very toxic and damaging and you kill these stem cells, then of course you'll never recover the sense of smell. Again, because those stem cells can't differentiate into these nice bipolar cells ever again. Okay, so in this olfactory apparatus, we got those receptor cells, right? Nice bipolar cells, support cells, and the basal cells. And those support cells act mostly for detoxifying things that are in our atmosphere. So odorant molecules got to bind to receptors, and all of these receptors act through G proteins. And we don't even know how many different kinds of G protein coupled receptors there are at the moment. So for taste, we said that there were five, right? But for smell, there are probably thousands of different kinds of receptors. Right, so it's much more complicated, so I won't even try to break down, I don't think I broke down any of those at all, no. But there's like musky, etheric, there's a whole class, but like I said, there's thousands of them, so we're not going to really memorize any of them. But the only thing that you should appreciate is that when you smell something, what has to happen if you smell something? Like, if I'm standing here and there's an odorant molecule over there on the tabletop, can I smell it? You can't. So I have to go there or it has to come to me, right? So it has to be able to dissolve in air, has to be able to get into my nose, and it has to bind to a receptor. So you can't appreciate smell at a distance. Some people are kind of supporting that hypothesis, but that's really not true. Right, so that odorant molecule has to bind to a receptor in your nose, and it's a G protein coupled receptor. And how would you explain the binding of that odorant molecule to a receptor that belongs to a G protein? By, wow, we can't leave ever unless we can figure that out. And spring break is coming right up. Wow, we got to figure that out fast. Okay, how does an odorant molecule bind to a receptor on a G that's associated with a G protein? How does it bind to a receptor? Something about an active site. I kind of like that idea. I remember active sites on enzymes. What binds on an active site of on an enzyme?
Substrate.
Substrate. What do you know about the relationship between a substrate and an active site on an enzyme? Yeah, it's by shape, right? It's by shape, complementary shape. Same thing here. Right, so the odorant molecule has to have a complementary shape to the receptor site, right, on the receptor of that G protein coupled mechanism. Right, so it's just all by shape. And if you change the shape of that molecule, then it won't bind to that receptor. It might bind to a different receptor. And, of course, then you'll have a different sense from that particular odorant molecule.
Why are there so many?
maybe over spring break I can figure out why there are so many. And why, or another way of saying that, why are there so few for taste? Okay? And we all know that lower forms of life require smell. They rely on their sense of smell much more than vision. All right? So I think in an evolutionary sense, smell has always been more important, much more sophisticated early on in evolution. But I still, that doesn't explain why there are so many different kinds. Okay. I just don't know why. All right, so let's go into hearing. And of course, that's a special sense because you can only hear two locations in your ears. And what we see right here is something we call the vestibular apparatus. All right, and vestibular apparatus, right? I see the vestibular apparatus here. I see semicircular canals, which is attached to the vestibular apparatus, and then there is something else attached to the vestibular apparatus. And it looks like a snail. What do we call this thing? That is the cochlea. That's right. Okay, so this is in the petrous region of your temporal bone. There are cavities, and then there is this bony structure. And inside the bony structure are the membranes and organs for perceiving sound, right? That's the hearing sense from the cochlea, linear acceleration from the vestibule, and angular acceleration from these semicircular canals. Oh, good, I brought a little water bottle. Maybe I can do a demonstration. All right, so this is what we call the inner ear. Here are the membranous labyrinths that are inside the bony labyrinth. The utricle and saccule are in the vestibule. And these ampullae, the crista ampullae, are in the semicircular canals. And the cochlear duct is in the cochlea. So those are the membranous labyrinths that are inside the corresponding bony labyrinths. Okay, I talked about that. All right, so let's talk about the vestibular apparatus and the, in particular, the utricle and saccule. And the utricle and saccule have sensory cells. All right, so here is one, and it has these stereocilia projecting up into the fluid that's inside that inner ear in that area. We call that endolymph. And when you start to move, okay, then it bends these stereocilia, and there are ion channels in the membrane. When you bend them, they can either open or close, right? So that's going to change the permeability of ions across the membrane, and that can either inhibit or excite, right? It can, if it hyperpolarizes, it inhibits. If it depolarizes, then it will excite that cell, and you'll have the sense of motion. So these cells right here are what we call hair cells because these stereocilia look like little hairs projecting off of them. All right, so in particular, let's look at the utricle and saccule in the vestibule. Write down on your notes that this is for linear acceleration, right? And not angular acceleration, but linear acceleration. But we should probably figure out what the heck is, what is acceleration? What's acceleration? Going from one velocity, one speed, to another speed, right? So it's a change in speed. That's what acceleration. If you're slowing down, that's deacceleration. If you're speeding up, that is acceleration. So if you're moving at a constant velocity, these hair cells won't give you any information. It's only when you're changing speed. All right, so how do these stereocilia get bent? Well, they project up into the vestibule, and they're embedded in a gelatinous mass. All right, so here I see a little gelatinous mass, and it's like you can look right through it. And embedded in the gelatinous mass and on top are what we call otoliths. Okay, and oto just means ear, right? And so these things act as little weights. So when your head is straight up and down, straight erect, then these otoliths push down straight on the stereocilia and they don't get bent. And hence they don't change the rate of action potentials to any place in the brain. But as soon as you bend your head forward or bend your face down, right, then these otoliths, right, start to bend the stereocilia, and you get the sense that your head is bending forward. And we can't talk about this in this class, but gravity acts like acceleration, right? Gravity really is acceleration. So when I'm you're sitting on your chair right now. Can you feel your chair up against your body? Yeah, you can feel it, right? And just like if you're in a car and you lean up against the chair in your car, your back, just think of your back. If you're not moving, is your back pressing up against the chair? Okay, not really. What happens if you hit the accelerator and you start moving really fast? Okay, then you get pushed back into the chair, right? So anytime you feel that pushing sensation, that is an acceleration that you're feeling with pressure receptors. And so you're feeling that right now with your legs, okay, because gravity acts like acceleration. It gives us that sense of pushing on something, which, all right, allows the utricle and saccule to get a sense of where gravity is with respect to other parts of your body, because gravity acts like acceleration. And these otoliths are calcium carbonate. And they're just little masses so that gravity can pull on them. So utricle is sensitive to horizontal acceleration. The saccule sensitive to vertical acceleration. And it's just in a linear form. So what is the kind of cell, the receptor cell, for linear acceleration? Yeah, see these hair cells right here? Good, just make a little note of that, hair cells. All right, there's another kind of equilibrium, right, that's associated with the semicircular canals. And what do I see on this slide? I see the membranous labyrinth, and I see this little bulge, that's the ampule of the semicircular canal, and this is where the sense organ is. Those are the, not utricle and saccule, but we call these the crista ampullaris in each of these little ampules. Right. And there is endolymph, right, inside these semicircular canals. And like any kind of fluid, it can flow. It can flow from one end of the semicircular canal, right, and maybe it can even flow all the way around a semicircular canal. Like if you're stirring a glass of water or something, right, then you can stir the water around. So how does this give us a sense of spinning? Okay. Or acceleration in particular. Well, because that fluid that fluid has mass, right? And any mass has another physical property. Right? And that property is that if mass is sitting still, then it likes to remain still. It doesn't like to change position. But if there is a mass in motion, then it doesn't like to change that particular motion either. It doesn't like to speed up, doesn't like to slow down, right? And we call that inertia. Any kind of mass has inertia, including that endolymph that we have within the membranous labyrinth of the semicircular canals. So what we're looking at here, okay, is inside the crista ampullaris. And I see some more hair cells, and you can see some stereocilia poking up into another thing that is sort of like a gelatinous mass, but it doesn't have otoliths. It's called the cupula. And it's pliable, so if endolymph is pushing on the cupula in one direction, that will inhibit these stereocilia. If it's pushing in the opposite direction, then that will excite these stereocilia. All depends on which way this fluid is moving. All right, so if you're stationary, all right, so the crista ampullaris is still, the endolymph is still not moving, and you start to spin, right, this crista ampullaris is attached to your head. So as soon as you start to spin, it's going to start to spin because it's attached to your body. Now the endolymph right here, what is it like to do when you begin? It likes to stay still. So the crista ampullaris is moving, crista ampullaris is moving, the endolymph is not moving, so that's going to push on the cupula, right? So, and then say you're spinning for a long period of time, maybe like a minute, 30 seconds, maybe you did that last night, Okay? And then all of a sudden, you stop suddenly. You have this sense of disorientation. You see some spinning. And that's also due to movement of stereocilia in the crista ampullaris. So what's happening there? Remember, when you start spinning, endolymph is not moving. But if you continue moving, then the endolymph catches up with your spinning rate, right? And then you won't receive any information about angular acceleration because you're not accelerating if you're spinning at a constant rate. And then all of a sudden you stop. Your crista ampullaris has stopped moving because it's attached to your head. But what about that endolymph, the fluid in the semicircular canals? It keeps going and it bends the cupula the other way because that endolymph has inertia in that semicircular canal. Okay. Does anybody have a tall water bottle? I have a short one. Maybe the short one might work. Should we do a little inertia experiment to see if I can do it? Do we know what we're talking about when we say inertia? Maybe. It needs to be maybe a little top head. This might be okay. All right, so Easter is coming. Maybe some of you are going to have family over to your house or go someplace, right? And you're going to put a bunch of stuff on a table, like wine glasses, candles, pitcher of margarita or something, right? Plates, silverware, all that kind of stuff. And you said, you know what, in physiology we learned something about inertia, and I can remove that tablecloth without disturbing any of the wine glasses. And nobody will believe you. But what can you do? You can walk over to the table, right? So here is all the stuff on the table. And if you yank the tablecloth really fast, because this mass right here has inertia, what will it want to do? Just stay stationary, right? Just like that. Because mass has inertia. All right. Now, what's the other possible condition? Okay. If we move it slow enough, yeah, if we move it slow enough, we can get that bottle moving, right? And then what happens if we stop? The bottle is going to want to keep moving because it has inertia. Now, how fast can I get this to go? Like that. Okay. So what would this be like? Okay. This would be like the endolymph in your ear. Okay, and then this would be the crista ampullaris. When you start to move the crista ampullaris, right, the endolymph is stationary. It's going to push on the cupula. But if you spin for a long period of time and then stop, the endolymph is going to push in the opposite direction on the cupula, and that's going to change the rate of action potentials going to your brain as a result of that. Okay, I want my Coke back. All right, so that's two senses within the ear. The third sense is hearing. And hearing is due to pressure waves that are moving through air. All right, so it's a physical wave. It's not like a light wave. It's a pressure wave. And the way that we characterize waves, right, is by their intensity. I guess I need to go to the board a little bit. What is intensity of a wave? What does a wave look like? Okay, so here is, oh, nice dark marker, that's nice. Okay, so here's a wave. You said, oh, I probably could have drawn that already, right? And what can you tell me about this wave? Well, here is the midpoint of that wave, and the intensity of this wave goes from this midpoint to whatever this top is, right? So if it is a wave like this, all right, so here's B. What's the intensity of B compared to A? It's greater, okay? But, all right, so I'm going to draw it down over here. There's another characteristic, and that's called frequency. And the frequency of A and B are exactly the same. It's just the intensity has changed. So in order to change the frequency, then in a certain period of time, like from here to here, we have to change the number of complete cycles, right? So here it goes positive, then negative, and then back to the origin. That is what we call one cycle. And if it happens in 1 second, then we call that one cycle per second, or 1 hertz. If it happens 1,000 times in 1 second, then that's 1,000 hertz. We can't hear at 1 hertz, but we can hear pretty well at 1,000. All right, so the number of cycles per time is what we call frequency. The amplitude is just the peak of this particular wave, or loudness. Anybody use the audiometer in lab? Anybody use the audiometer? Yeah, some people are shaking. I don't see any hands, but I see some head shaking. Okay. All right, so cycles per second is the same thing as a hertz. So 1,000 cycles per second is 1,000 hertz. And how can you relate to hertz or cycles per second? If there are very few cycles per second or very few hertz in a particular wave, it is going to sound like a low note. Right? And if there are a lot of cycles per second, it's going to sound as a high note. So you can tell pitch by not the intensity, but by the frequency of that particular wave. Okay. And let's look at the ear. So here we see an ear. This is just a quick review from anatomy. You see the three components of the ear. You got external, middle, and inner. Right? And that external just has that auditory meatus and this little auricle to help funnel sound into the external acoustic meatus. And then that sound wave is going to bump up against this membrane called the tympanic membrane. This is just like a head of a drum. When that sound pressure reaches this membrane, what is this membrane going to do if everything is all nice and healthy? Yeah, it's going to vibrate, right, with the same frequency of that sound energy that's entering the ear, right? It's just going to move back and forth. And connected to this membrane, right, are some auditory ossicles, like the malleus, and then these auditory ossicles start to vibrate. So that sound, right, sort of gets transduced into motion of these bones, right? And then the third bone in this set right here is the stapes. It's going to move back and forth, and you can see it is pushing up against the vestibule of the bony labyrinth that we were just talking about. All right, so the middle ear contains these auditory ossicles, and the external ear, you could think of maybe the tympanic membrane as part of the external ear, right? And then the inner ear has this structure here, the bony labyrinth for hearing is not the vestibule, not semicircular canals, but the cochlea. It looks like a snail. I see another tube running through here. It helps connect the middle ear with your pharynx. What's another name for pharynx? Your throat, right? And so sometimes it's called the eustachian tube, sometimes auditory tube, sometimes called pharyngotympanic tube. It's got a bunch of different names. But the job of this thing is, right, to make sure that it equalizes the pressure of the middle ear to the atmosphere, right? So, for instance, if the pressure in the middle ear started to become greater than the atmospheric pressure, then the middle ear would push this tympanic membrane further and further into the external acoustic meatus, and if it pushed it far enough, then the tympanic membrane couldn't vibrate. And if it couldn't vibrate, what would be your sense of hearing? What would you hear? You would hear nothing, right? Because the tympanic membrane has got to vibrate back and forth. Or if there's high pressure in on the external side of the tympanic membrane and very low in the middle, then the tympanic membrane, again, is going to get pushed the other way, and it won't be able to vibrate, and you won't be able to hear anything. Okay. So typically when you're flying in an airplane, traveling up and down in the mountains, right, you're going to adjust, maybe hold your breath or do some kind of Valsalva maneuver or something to equalize the pressure, open up this auditory tube so that the tympanic membrane can start vibrating. If it dislocates a large distance, it's very painful, right? So it's actually a good thing to do. Not only does it allow you to hear better, but it can relieve a lot of pain. If you have a cold or an inflammation or allergies, you might not be able to equalize, and that could be very painful. What population has inflammation of the middle ear frequently? Kids do. That's right, kids do. And that's called otitis media. Probably you know that already. And so that's an inflammation. This cavity here, the middle part of the ear, gets filled with fluid, right? So the tympanic membrane can't vibrate back and forth. And that causes inflammation other parts of the ear. But the bad thing is, because there's fluid, it can't equalize. Pressure cannot equalize. So typically when a little kid goes on an airplane ride from one place to another, their ears are hurting terribly. And so on takeoff and landing, they're crying, and that's just the way it is. There's not much you can do for that particular circumstance. Certainly you can't discipline them, but just remember their ears are hurting. It feels like they're going to explode a little bit. Talk to your physician about that, because they might be able to prescribe some or recommend some antihistamines or some other kind of anti-inflammatory medication. But just don't give little kids drugs without consulting with your physician. Okay? Even though you would like for them to be comfortable and not scream when you're taking off, right? Okay, so the stapes is right up against another membrane called the oval window, and then that produces that sound energy into the endolymph of the inner ear. All right, so the tympanic membrane surface is very large. The surface of the oval window is very small. These bones right here kind of act like an amplifier, because it's very difficult for sound energy to enter a fluid environment. And maybe over the weekend you could prove that to yourself. Get into a pool, sauna, or whatever, and have a conversation with somebody that's standing on the deck, and you'll be able to hear them just fine. Maybe you can even think of this in your mind. And then put your head underwater and have your friend talk to you at the same intensity. What happens? You can't really hear them, because sound energy has a terrible time getting into water. So this apparatus, the tympanic membrane, oval window, and these auditory ossicles, is just a fancy way of getting that sound energy into the jacuzzi or the pool, right? Because that's what endolymph is like. Okay. All right, so the cochlea is a really long structure, and it's just rolled up like a snail. If we unroll it, this is what we see. All right, so here is that oval window connected to the stapes. Here's the malleus connected to the tympanic membrane, and the incus is right in between them. Oh, nice pharyngotympanic tube. All right, so sound energy enters through the oval window, and it enters a chamber that we call the scala vestibuli. All right, and that pressure wave moves through the scala vestibuli, and sometimes, right, it can go all the way to the end of the cochlea that we call the helicotrema, and then the pressure wave comes back down over here, right, down through the scala tympani, right, vestibuli is on the top, tympani is on the bottom, and here is another membrane called the round window, and it vibrates back and forth, and it relieves that sound pressure from the cochlea, because if it got trapped in there, then it could actually damage these membranes, right? So that's like a little pressure release valve that's releasing pressure all the time. All right, but there's something different. The structure, the size of the cochlea is different whether you're at the helicotrema or close to the tympanic membrane. The cochlea is thickest at the helicotrema and thinnest over here by the tympanic membrane. That's hard to appreciate with, how can I go back? Hard to appreciate, if I go like that. Oh, it's hard to appreciate when you just look at a two-dimensional diagram that this part right here is actually the biggest part, the thickest part of the cochlea, and the thinnest is this one over here. All right, I should have brought my violin, because that's exactly how the scroll on the violin looks like. Okay, look at a cello or violin or something. Okay, you'll see that this inner part is actually the thickest part. Well, why does size or thickness matter in terms of frequency, whether it's a low note or high note or a mid-range note? Can you think of maybe a guitar? I think maybe everybody has seen a guitar. And a guitar can play low notes or it can play high frequency notes on different strings. And what can you tell me about the different strings? Are they the same thickness?
No.
They are different, right? Which one can play low notes? The thin one or the thick one? Yeah, the thick one. It just vibrates. It has a natural tendency to vibrate at a lower frequency based on its size, right? And the thin wires can vibrate at a very high frequency, okay, because they are much thinner. Also, the length of those strings matters sometimes too, and that's what, like in a piano you would see that, or a harp or something like that. The longer the string is, the lower the frequency that it will vibrate at, and the shorter it is, the higher the frequency. And that's exactly how this cochlea works. All right, so sound energy enters the scala vestibuli, and depending on the frequency, if it's high frequency, it will go across this middle part right here that we call the organ of Corti, very close to the tympanic membrane, and excite nerves in this region. If it's low frequency, it will penetrate the cochlea a longer distance before it passes through the cochlear duct and the organ of Corti, stimulating these receptor cells out over here. And different parts of the brain then are wired to these different locations in the cochlea. So when I look at the cochlear duct, it reminds me of a piano. All right, so I see high frequencies over here, low frequencies over here, just like a piano, but it's kind of reversed, right, if you know anything about a piano. But that's okay. Different ends of the piano play what different frequency kind of notes. And that's based on size, right? That's based on the size of the cochlear duct and the organ of Corti that's inside. So here you can see, what, 20,000 hertz, 2,000, 500 hertz. What is a faster frequency, 500 or 20,000? Yeah, 20,000. So I think you have a pretty good understanding of what frequency is, right? So high frequencies pass across, right, close to the tympanic membrane because this is the thinnest part, right, while the slower frequencies pass through closer to the helicotrema because this is the thickest part. All right, so let's zoom in to the cochlea. I see that scala vestibuli that's connected to the tympanic membrane, and here's the scala tympani connected to the, scala vestibuli is connected to the oval window. Scala tympani is connected to the round window, and sometimes sound energy can pass directly through the cochlear duct, right? All depending on the frequency, it has to have the right frequency to match up with the size of the cochlear duct. All right, so what do I see? I see a tectorial membrane. But I tell you what, we should probably zoom into this area, right? This area is inside the cochlear duct, that middle chamber. So here is what we're going to be looking at. Here is the tectorial membrane. It is like a gelatinous mass, right? What kind of cell was sending stereocilia up into a gelatinous mass in those other senses we were looking at? Hair cells, right, for both angular acceleration and linear acceleration. And here we have some more hair cells. These are the receptor cells. They have stereocilia. They're connected to the tectorial membrane. So when sound energy passes through the cochlear duct and the tectorial membrane starts to vibrate, it deforms the stereocilia, opening or closing various ion channels, right, which can either inhibit or excite these sensory neurons, which then send action potentials to eventually the temporal lobe. Okay. So this thing right here is what we call the organ of Corti. Right? The organ of Corti is within the cochlear duct. Anybody got a question on that? So what is strange? What's the receptor cell for linear acceleration, angular acceleration, and hearing? It is a hair cell. So that is really strange, right? You have that same kind of cell responsible for those three different sensations. And of course, these action potentials don't go to the side of the cortex for equilibrium. They go to the primary auditory cortex. And okay, just like I said, the cochlea acts like a piano. Guess what? You have a piano in the temporal lobe as well. Right, so over here would become excited. You would have the sensation of low frequency. Out over here, when these cells get excited, you have the sensation of high frequency and the range of frequencies in between. All right, so why is the cochlea all wound up like this? I hear surface area. I like that. Space, that's right. Because if it was all unrolled like this, you would have like two pianos sticking out of your ear. Okay, so it's rolled up, but it's still, think of it as a linear structure, even though it's all curled up. Okay, I want to stop this program for a second, and I want to pull up something that I have for you in Blackboard. Where is it? Right here. Okay, structures and functions of the special senses of the labyrinth. Where do you find the labyrinth? It's your ear. What part of your ear? The inner ear. And I think you know three parts of the labyrinth. You know the semicircular canals, you know, the vestibule and the cochlea. Those are all parts that make up the labyrinth. And you can get an infection of that that's called a labyrinthitis, and it might disrupt your balance, right? Might disrupt your hearing, right? And these things are in the petrous region of the temporal bone. And here are those three senses that we were talking about: hearing, linear acceleration, that sense we call static equilibrium, right? And angular acceleration we call kinetic equilibrium. So you should make sure you know that linear acceleration means static equilibrium, and angular acceleration, what's another way of saying angular acceleration? Like spinning, right? Spinning, yeah, rotation. That is what we call kinetic equilibrium. All right, so we've got a number of different spaces in the ear. We've got the external ear. The external ear is necessary for which of these senses? For hearing, static, or kinetic equilibrium? Hearing. And is it only hearing? As a matter of fact, that's true, right? So yes, no, no. What about the middle ear? What sense requires the middle ear to be functioning properly? Hearing only, not static or kinetic equilibrium, right? So yes, no, no. All right, what about the internal ear? All three, right? The semicircular canals, vestibule, and cochlea have to be functioning properly. And you should know what the bony labyrinth is for hearing, bony labyrinth for static, bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium. And here it is, cochlea for hearing, vestibule for static equilibrium, and the semicircular canals for for angular acceleration. Inside the bony labyrinth, you have the membranous labyrinth that holds the fluid. And in the ear, that's for hearing, we call that the cochlear duct. For static equilibrium, it's the utricle and saccule. And for kinetic equilibrium, it's the semicircular ducts. And the cochlear duct contains an organ for hearing. It's called the organ of Corti. And the organ for static equilibrium is maculae. And I don't know if you could remember this, but the receptor organ for angular acceleration is the crista ampullaris. All right, so which one of these organs right here has otoliths, those little stones, those little crystals in your ear? The maculae. The maculae have the otoliths, little crystals. All right, which one has the cupula? The crista ampullaris, right. Which one has a tectorial membrane? The organ of Corti does. All right, and now what about the receptor cell for hearing? Yeah, it says all hair cells right here, and indeed it is. Okay, I usually try to confuse people, but I can't confuse you guys. It's always going to be a hair cell. All right, so that's pretty good for hearing. I'm going to give you a little bit of an orientation for vision. And is vision a...
I have
a question. Oh, good. Yes, what is your good question?
So for the special sense, they receive the information, they have to go to for the hearing, have to go to three processes before they go to the brain, and from the brain they get the information, right?
Well, most sensory information, okay, is started with a receptor cell that goes to a sensory neuron, right? Sensory neuron brings it into the thalamus, and then that excites a third neuron, which takes it to a particular place in the cortex for your appreciation. So the thalamus is like a relay center, directing action potentials to the proper place inside the brain. Okay? So if the thalamus gets action potentials from the ear, but directs it to the occipital lobe, what's going to be your experience? You're going to see something, even though it's sound pressure, right? So that's the job of the thalamus. Okay, but your question was, once it gets to the cortex?
No, we have to something stimulate us first, and then we have the receptor.
Yeah, you need some kind of energy in the external environment, like sound pressure or light, for instance, odorant molecules, olfactory molecules. And then that signal gets transduced by receptors into action potentials that go to the brain. And that's where you perceive things, is in the cerebral cortex. Okay. All right, so vision. This is our last special sense. Vision will respond to waves as well, but not pressure waves, not physical waves, but electromagnetic waves. And so part of the wave is electronic, part is magnetic. All right, so here is the whole spectrum. Right, we have radio waves, microwaves, infrared, ultraviolet, x-rays. All of these things come from the sun, including this very narrow band of electromagnetic rays that we call visible light. And these are all different in frequency. And if you take the inverse of frequency, you get the length of the wave, or called wavelength. So you could think of wavelength as being the same thing as frequency. Right? So the higher frequencies are up over here. The lower frequencies are down over here. And it also contains a different amount of energy, a little bit different amount of energy. And with normal vision, you can actually tell these different energy levels because they appear as a different color of light. Right? And I can't tell you what these colors are, but I could pretend. This is red, here's orange, yellow, green. Green, blue, indigo, and violet. Okay, that's because you just memorize what the order of these different colors is, and I know which end is which, right? I can tell this is more blue than this one over here, so that's got to be violet. All right, so that's not really too important for this class, but if you want to really know, this is what we call the visible light spectrum, or you could say that's a rainbow that you see in the sun. And the way that you remember what colors are next to each other, you just have to introduce yourself to this gentleman called Roy G. Biv. Okay, and that describes what colors come after each other. Okay. All right, so it's the job of your eyes to change these different energies of light into action potentials. Right, and then, you know, these action potentials have to go to the occipital lobe for your appreciation of that color of light. All right, well, you have some accessory structures in your eye. All right, so they're not directly related to sensation of those light rays, but they help the light, they help the eye function. One of the things is this pupil right here. If it's very dim, this pupil is going to dilate, it's going to get very large, it's going to let a lot of light enter the eye. If it's very bright, then the pupil is going to constrict, it's going to get smaller, right? And that's going to help protect the eye in bright light conditions. Well, you can't control the diameter of the pupil. It's controlled by smooth muscle in particular, and that's involuntary, right? So we have two different kinds of muscles. And which makes the iris, right? So the iris controls the diameter of the pupil. And so I see some radial, right? They just look like spokes coming, projecting away from the pupil, right? So those are what we call radial muscles. And then we see some circular muscles as well. So there are two different kinds of smooth muscles in the eye. And in dim light, right, the circular muscles are relaxed, right, and the radial muscles are excited. And so here is information from the autonomic nervous system causing contraction of these radial muscles, and that's done by when this contracts. So think of how we're going to figure out if this is sympathetic or parasympathetic. What would you rely on? How would you characterize sympathetic? Fight or flight? And parasympathetic as rest and digest. All right, well, when you're in a stressful situation, should you allow a lot of light into your eyes or very little? A lot, so that you have good vision, right? So sympathetic stimulation causes contraction of these radial fibers that increases the diameter of the pupil, right? And when it's very bright out, then the parasympathetic nervous system takes over the rest and digest, and it causes constriction of the circular smooth muscle, and that constricts the pupil. That happens under bright light conditions. All right, so that's pretty easy to understand, right? The radial muscles or the circular muscles, and which one are innervated by the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, accommodation is a little bit different. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong clock. Okay, accommodation. What the heck is accommodation? It's a little dim in here, but I think we can do a bit of an experiment. It just so happens, because of the laws of physics, when you look at something, you can only have a sharp image of an object at one distance from your eye. You can either focus things clear up close or focus and get something clear that's far away. So let's put your arm out in front of your eyes, right, and stretch it out, and then concentrate on your fingertips, your fingernail, so that your fingernails, is it too dark for you to see your fingernails? Can you see them? Probably. Now, focus on your fingernails, and are they nice and sharp and clear? Now, what about the background? But still focus on the fingernails. It's blurry. I still see it, but it's all smeared out, right? Okay, now keep your fingernails there and look past them to something far away. What happens to your fingernails? They're all blurry, right? So that process of changing where you focus, what distance from your eyes, is called accommodation. And the thing that's responsible for that is that the lens in your eye has to change shape in order for accommodation to take place. All right, so how do we change the shape of something? The kind of tissue is muscle tissue. So there's another smooth muscle that we call the ciliary body or ciliary muscle that surrounds the lens, and it's pretty much the same diameter of the cornea. Do you guys remember from anatomy what the cornea is? I hope so. Okay, so here's the lens. And the lens can bend light depending on the curvature of the lens, right? And the lens is connected to the ciliary muscle by these suspensory ligaments. Now, here is something strange, right? It's not very intuitive how it works, but this slide, I think, shows it pretty well. Okay, when a muscle contracts, if it's a circular muscle and it contracts, like your orbicularis oculi, contract your orbicularis oculi, what happens? Do your eyelids come together, or do they open up more when you contract? Okay. Yeah. Or if you contract your orbicularis oris, does your mouth open or close? It closes when you contract. Okay. So the contracted form of that ciliary muscle I see on the bottom. All right, so it looks a little bit thicker, but the diameter of this circle is going to be smaller. When it shrinks down, when the diameter of this ciliary body shrinks down, it reduces the tension on these suspensory ligaments, and that reduces the tension on the lens. And so when that happens, then the lens, right, there's nothing pulling on it, it gets more curvature to it, which is kind of strange. All right, so it's when the ciliary body contracts that produces less tension on the lens, so it becomes more curved. When the ciliary body relaxes, right, then the diameter of that ciliary body enlarges, and that's when tension is placed on these suspensory ligaments, stretching out the lens, making the curvature less. Right, so it's just kind of a funny arrangement. Usually when you increase tension on a muscle, you increase tension on the ligaments that pull on a part of, like, a bone. Well, that works a little bit different for accommodation. All right, so you can see that the lens is changing shape from this condition to this condition. And that is due to the ciliary body. That function is called accommodation. What did I want to see? Okay, at long distances, when light is coming from a long distance, light rays are pretty much parallel to each other. They're no longer diverging. So it doesn't take a very strong lens to get them to focus back on the retina. Right? So the lens has less curvature when you're looking at something far away. But when you're looking at something close, the light rays are moving faster away from each other. Right? And it takes more of a curvature of the lens to focus them on the retina. Right, so the ciliary body is contracted when you're looking at something up close. It's relaxed when you're looking at something far away. All right, so here's an exam figure. All right, so here I see the shape of an eyeball. Here are some long eyeballs. Right, here are some shorter ones up over here. And I see the lens. And there's something else. There's something else that looks like a lens if we look at an eyeball. You see another part of the eye that light goes through that has curvature associated with it. Look at this right here. Here's the cornea. That's right. So the cornea actually is the most important lens on your eye that focuses so that you can see things nice and sharp, but the cornea can't change shape. So it can't make, it can't accommodate, right, objects at different distances. So the job of the lens, right, is for accommodation, but it's not the brute force lens for vision, for seeing something sharp. All right, so here light is going through the cornea and through the lens, and it's bending it back to a particular point on the retina. And the retina is right, you know, it's just right up against the choroid, up against the sclera. And this light, even though all these light rays are kind of separated from each other, they have originated from a particular point in space. Right? They just come from one point. And so for you to visualize that one point, all of this light, as it's bending away from this point, has to be focused back on a single point, on the retina. So it's the job of the cornea and the lens to bend that light back from that one point back to just a single point on the retina so that things look really nice and clear. All right. When that happens without any kind of glasses or anything, we call that emmetropia. That's normal vision. Light rays are focused right on the retina. And no correction, no glasses are needed to correct for this particular condition. Well, what happens if the eyeball is a little bit long? It gets a little bit stretched out. Well, light is going to still focus, right, at the same spot, which in this particular case is in front of the retina, and then it starts to diverge once again after it passes through here. And so now you don't see a point of light, you see a smearing of light. Something is not clear, right? Things look blurry. We call that myopia or nearsightedness. And in order to correct for this situation, what do we have to do? We have to spread these light rays out a little bit before they enter the eye so that when they get overcompensated, they start to focus on the retina once again. And that happens with a concave lens. That corrects for nearsightedness, right? So nearsighted because light is focusing in front of the retina. Well, it could be that somebody's eyeball is too short, in which case this light is going to focus behind the retina, and again, as it passes through, it's going to look all blurry. So here is a shorter eye, and this is what we call farsightedness, right, or hyperopia. And in order for this to be corrected, we need a convex lens, which starts to bend the light together before it enters the eye. Right, so here's a nice convex lens, which starts to bend the light back together before it even enters the eye, and that corrects for an eye that is a little bit shorter. Now, this all assumes, right, myopia and hyperopia assumes that there is very nice symmetry of the cornea and the lens, but that might not necessarily be so because the curvature of the cornea on the top might be different than the curvature on the bottom, or the curvature of the lens might be different on the top compared to the bottom, or the right and left curvature might be different from each other, right? And that's what we call astigmatism. I don't see any distortion on this illustration right here, right? So maybe it looks like there's more curvature up over here than down over here. And in order to correct that, then you need an uneven lens to get light to focus back on the retina. So astigmatism is when you look at an object, so you're looking at the screen, right, and you're focusing maybe on the bottom, and the bottom is nice and clear, but the top is out of focus, right? Or you're focusing on the bottom and the lateral, the edges are out of focus, right? And that's because there's not perfect symmetry of the lens and the cornea. And you can take care of that with this uneven lens. All right, we got to start talking about the photoreceptor cells in the retina. Now, do you remember how many different layers there are in the eye? I don't even have a slide that shows that. Okay, maybe I do have a slide. We can make this slide work. What are the layers of the eye? There are three. What's the outermost layer called?
Sclera.
Okay, that's called the sclera. You're right. I almost told you the wrong thing. It is the sclera. It's the white part of the eye. It's really tough. Right, and then the middle layer right here is the choroid, and it contains blood vessels. Right, and then the third layer I see right here, too bad I can't describe that color to you, but it looks light to me, and that is the retina. And the retina contains photoreceptor cells. You need to have those photoreceptors to appreciate light, and that's why blood vessels are in the choroid, because if they were in the retina, then you couldn't have photoreceptor cells and you would have a blind spot wherever that blood vessel was traveling through the retina. Okay, so what are the special kinds of cells in the retina that allow you to perceive light? All right, so light is coming in the eye. This is the direction of light. Light has to pass through a bunch of different neurons before it reaches the photoreceptor cells that are deep inside the retina, which to me seems kind of funny because maybe you would want these photoreceptor cells, right, the first cells to receive that light, but it doesn't happen that way. You notice the shapes of these photoreceptor cells. How many different shapes do you see? Yeah, as a matter of fact, you probably see two different colors, right? There are cells that have a pointy shape. We call these cones. And then there's others that, right, don't have a conical shape to them. They look more like a rod. So you have these two different kinds of cells, rods and cones. And this slide is a little bit misleading because the rod cells are bigger than the cone cells. I think that's important for you to realize, and we'll get to that in just a second. All right, so cone cells are a lot smaller. All right, so here's some differences between the rods and cones. The cones give you color vision. Rod cells give you grayscale, black and white. Okay, cone cells, because they're so small, give you high resolution. They give you very sharp edges, right? So high resolution because they're really small cells. And because the rods are large, they can only produce blurry type images, right? So you might be wondering, well, what good are these grayscale images that are blurry? Well, this is a big difference. The rod cells are very sensitive to light. So they can send action potentials to the brain under very dim light conditions. So you can see, you can't see colors in dim light, right? And you have very little ability to recognize edges and sharp images. Right? Cone cells, on the other hand, right, give you color vision, nice sharp edges, high resolution, but it needs bright light. And we're not always in bright light, right? And if you only had cone cells and you didn't have bright light, then you couldn't see anything at all. Right? So you need a combination of these cells. Well, where light enters or hits the retina, right, is the fovea centralis. It's right in the posterior pole of the eye. That's where we have the majority of cone cells. That gives us our best color vision and best resolution, our sharpest vision. And of course, we use our extrinsic eye muscles to move our eyeball around so that when light enters the eye, it hits that fovea centralis directly. Rod cells are in your peripheral vision. And we don't use our peripheral vision very much, right? But with training, you can. And maybe you could do a little experiment when you go outside tonight or the night after. And in your peripheral vision, without looking at a star directly, you can see a star in your peripheral vision someplace, okay, and concentrate on it, and then change your vision so you're looking directly at that star, okay, and you might notice that the star disappears. And that's because in your peripheral vision to see that star, you were using rod cells, right, and then when you change your vision so that the star was right in the center of your visual field, then you only have cone cells, and it disappeared because the light from that star is just not bright enough to activate those cone cells. Who's ever done that little experiment? Everybody has, right? Raise your hand if you have. Wow, only one person. Wow, you guys got a lot of homework to do then. Okay, well, when you look with your peripheral vision, what else about that star can you tell me? You see it there, but what can you tell me about that star? It's a little blurry. What else? What happens if it's a red giant? You can't see what color it is. You just know that there's a light up there. And then when you look right at it to tell what color it is, guess what? It disappears because it just doesn't have the right kind of intensity. Okay. On this slide, you also see, here's a neuron. What's the shape of this neuron right here? It's bipolar, right? So again, bipolar, we said, was for special sensation. The retina is another place where we have it. You have some other kinds of neurons that we call amacrine. You have some horizontal cells over here. And these cells just process light information before it even gets to the brain. So there's a lot of signal processing of light for resolution and color by these various cells before it even gets into the optic nerve. Okay. All right, so here's a better representation of a rod and cone cell. You can see the really small cone right here, relatively large rod. You might notice that there's almost something that looks like striations, right, in what we call the outer segment of the cell. And the outer segment of the cell doesn't contain mitochondria, doesn't contain the nucleus, right? That's all contained within the inner segment of a rod or cone cell. But there's something very special in this outer segment, right? It's made up of discs. And let's take a look at a disc. Where are these discs at? Oh, I don't have a picture of a disc. This is where molecules that absorb light are located, right? And remember, we said that light is made up of different colors, different frequencies, and different energy levels. And depending on the frequency of light, it will vibrate, right, or excite different shaped molecules, just like sound waves. And let's look and see what a rod cell does. All right, so we're going to just be talking about a rod cell. Here is a molecule that we call rhodopsin. All right, so rhodopsin is a molecule that's part opsin and part retinol. Retinol can have two conformations. It can have a curved conformation or it can have a straight conformation. When it's curved, it can fit into the opsin molecule, making a nice rhodopsin. When it's in a straight configuration, then it can no longer fit into the active site. So what causes this change in retinol? It is light. It just happens to have the right kind of shape so that it can absorb light energy. And when it does, it changes shape. Can you see the curved shape? Right, so here is a cis conformation, here is an all-trans conformation, and that's due to these double bonds, the arrangement of these double bonds. If there were single bonds all the way up and down this hydrocarbon chain, then it couldn't change conformation. Right. When light hits this retinol and it changes conformation, we call that a bleaching reaction. The bleaching reaction is when retinol absorbs light, right, and it straightens out and can no longer fit in the opsin molecule. And when that happens, that changes the permeability of ions of the rod and cone cells, but we're just talking about rod cells, changes the permeability of rod cells, right, which then change the frequency of action potentials going to the brain. All right, so let's look at, I'm not even going to read this to you. I want to describe this slide first. And I will do it next time. But I do want to tell you one thing. Usually, when there's stimulus present, that's when action potentials go to the brain. All right, that's when something gets stimulated. All right, when the stimulus is present, that's when that's when receptor cells become stimulated. Vision is a little bit opposite. It's in the presence of the stimulus, the receptor cells become inhibited, which is really strange. So you got to come back and see how that happens. Why does a stimulus inhibit a cell and the absence of stimulus excite the cell? And we know a lot about that.